My name is Nick Barker, and this is a conversation with my friend and colleague Alex Jackson about autism. Alex, can we start with maybe the most obvious question of all, which is, what is autism?
Before we get started, I just want to make the point that I can only experience life through my lens. I mean, it's all any of us can actually do. So whenever I talk about what I experience or the terms I use or how I see things, just know I'm only speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for every autistic person out there. The reason I'm doing this is I hope my experience can offer some insights into what another colleague may be experiencing that, I don't know, maybe by my opening up, someone may be afforded some compassion I didn't have. Or maybe someone might resonate with my experiences and discover something about themselves. Maybe something might start to make more sense and they feel less alone. Before I even started looking into if I was autistic, I remember feeling like I was wired differently to everyone else. I remember saying that so many times. And I didn't know really how to feel about that or what it meant. I mean, I didn't know anything about neurodiversity back then. Honestly, I thought I was going crazy because everyone else seemed to be crazy. So if everybody else is crazy, that means you're the crazy one because not everybody else is crazy, right? I mean, that's our society, isn't it? And the funny thing is, it turns out I was right. I am wired differently to everyone else. But that's why raising awareness is so important. And ultimately, I'm doing this to try and raise awareness and to help, because I don't want anyone else to have to go through some of the things I've been through. Or if I can open the eyes of managers and make them realise that how a simple request for one person could actually involve an enormous, if not actually impossible, amount of effort for another, and have some appreciation and understanding of the difficulties, then I would have done what I've set out to do.
So to answer your question, what is autism? To be autistic means your brain developed differently to the normal standard, which is known as neurotypical, or NT for short, and it's something you're born with. This can become obvious when it comes to social communication and interaction, and can be characterised by developmental delays. So as an example, I was mute until I was four, but when I did talk, it was in full grammatically correct sentences.
Wow.
Because the brain has developed differently, you will find that autistic people can have sensory profiles that differ wildly from a neurotypical, so something you can't even detect could be causing physical pain to someone who is autistic. Mm-hmm. Now, if I was to describe autism from my perspective, I would say primarily it's an energy and stress anxiety management condition. Whatever activity I undertake, I need to first assess whether I have the energy right now to do the task, but I also have to factor my environment for the stress aspect. I need to be able to disaster plan. Unexpected events can take a massive toll on me. I have to have a plan for it. If something unexpected happened, I would dwell on it and assess how it happened, why I didn't have a plan for it, and think what I could do in the future to mitigate that event happening again or the effect it actually had on me. So if I pick a hobby, let's say animal photography at the zoo, first I have to ask myself, do I have the energy to lug my camera equipment around and be on my feet all day? Mm-hmm. And if that's a yes, then I have to assess how busy I think the roads are going to be. And I'll time my departure so I can arrive as close to the zoo opening time as I can, whilst taking into account what roads I'll be driving along, how familiar I am with them and how busy they might be at that time. Now I will consider petrol. I don't like filling the car up. I absolutely hate it. And right. I can't drive off somewhere and fill up along the way, because what if I don't see a petrol station when I really need one? So I'll make sure the car's filled up before I go and factor in that time. What about parking at the zoo? Parking's something else I find really stressful. If it's a place I go to regularly, I will have my spot that I always go to, but somewhere I've not been to or don't visit regularly gives me anxiety. What's the weather going to be doing? If it's really bright and sunny, then if it's a zoo with lots of glass enclosures, which most of them are now, I probably won't go because I'd find it hard to fight through the glare and I'd risk getting people's reflections in my photos.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, I have to plan out what I'm going to wear. And it needs to be something dark and long-sleeved so I can use my body to block off light and stop all the reflections. What am I going to eat? Although I've gotten better over the years, I tend to find at zoos especially that there really isn't much of anything for me to pick from. I will always study any menus available online to see if I can find something, and if I'm not confident, then I need to pack a lunch, but do I pack something I can take around with me or something I can leave in the car? Can I even get back to the car once I'm in the zoo? How's my energy currently? If something went wrong, do I have the mental capacity to problem solve my way out of any issues that might arise? Now, if I think I've solved all of those problems, next I consider how busy I think the zoo is going to be. Will I be able to handle the amount of people that are going to be there? And during the school holidays or a bank holiday, the answer is just no. And even though I love going to the zoo, I refuse to go on those days. Yeah. There's too many people. It's far too much noise to wade through. It's too draining. I just won't enjoy it. And this is just an example of my thought process and how I might plan out something that might be quite a simple decision for a neurotypical, but becomes a military operation for me before I can even leave the house. And this is just surface level. There are many more things I'll consider and factor before that decision is made. And I give myself the green light to go ahead and do something I want to do.
Alex, thanks. That's a kind of amazing insight for me into how you would need to plan and cover eventualities before doing something that, as you said, might strike a neurotypical person as very straightforward. The second question that I wanted to ask you is about vocabulary. So can you help me to get the vocabulary right? I've heard terms autism, Asperger's, ASD. Could you talk a little about each of those and say which terms are helpful and which are not?
Sure. So basically, all of these terms mean the same thing. It's a way to say somebody is autistic. Asperger's is slightly different. It's a diagnosis that's no longer given. It was replaced by ASD 9-10 years ago. My understanding, and I could be wrong on all of the specifics, is that Asperger's basically means you're autistic and your IQ is above 70, but now all forms of autism are given an ASD diagnosis. Mm-hmm. For those who do have an Asperger's diagnosis, however, they might prefer to be referred as somebody with Asperger's, or they may call themselves an ASPE. As for what is more helpful, I think that depends on the individual. So I'll touch on two points that are an area for debate in the community. So the first is ASD versus ASC, disorder versus condition. There are some who feel strongly about keeping the diagnosis as ASD, as they may have or know someone who has high support needs, for example. Others feel strongly about changing the diagnosis to ASC, saying something is a condition is a lot less negative than calling it a disorder.
Right.
For me personally, I'm on the fence. For the same reason, I don't like the functioning labels. People who call somebody either high or low functioning based on the amount of support they need. Well, most people would say I'm high functioning, and all I can say is I'm high functioning until I'm not.
Yep.
I've locked myself in a room feeling overwhelmed, unable to stand noise or light, unable to speak, well, that doesn't sound high functioning to me. And going to a busy supermarket, which I already take measures to avoid as much as possible, is enough to trigger this. The second is whether someone prefers to use person first or identity first language. So the difference between being an individual with autism or an autistic individual. I have a strong identity first preference, as for me, being autistic is what makes me who I am. I wouldn't be me without it, and being diagnosed as an adult and my previous experiences has probably influenced that preference. However, what I tend to see in the autism community is children prefer to be person first and describe themselves as having autism. I think that stems from not wanting the autism to define them. And sadly, I feel that's because of the stigma that still surrounds autism. So to know what's helpful, you really need to speak to the individual to see what they prefer.
That's a great answer. Yeah, thanks, Alex. But I think, yeah, as I said, that's a really helful answer to me to try and get the vocabulary right. You've been very open with me about how you were formally diagnosed as autistic as an adult. What led to you to discover that you are autistic?
I'd noticed things throughout my life that I knew weren't the same as other people, but I didn't know what to even look at or to try and determine why I felt like that. So my husband was the one who suggested autism. One night I was walking on my toes, which is something I always do around the house, and he asked me why I toe walk. And I was a bit framed by this because it's just something I've always done, certainly from the age of 7, maybe even earlier. It's just natural for me to do. So he decided to look into it and said to me, you might be autistic. And at the time, I thought autism was a mental illness. Very clearly, I didn't know anything about it. And I thought to myself, because I walk on my toes, I'm mentally ill. All right then, whatever. But he encouraged me to read about what he'd found. And I thought, okay, this kind of sounds like me. Maybe I should look into it. And that's when I remembered a boss I had when I was in New Zealand. As an insult, she said I must be autistic or something. She didn't make it a secret how much she didn't like me, and even said when I left, she was glad I was going, but wished she could keep my brain because I absorb things. So I started to watch YouTube videos of people who are autistic describing their experiences. And I was shocked how much I could relate. I watched a lot of these videos and found myself agreeing with things like what they found annoying, what they struggle with, that kind of thing. There was one thing, however, that made me think I wasn't autistic, and that was the need for routine. I'd always prided myself on being flexible. If something needed doing unexpectedly, you can give it to me, I'll get it done. I didn't think inflexibility fitted me, and it's a big part of being autistic. At the time, I was working in finance, and as a quick aside, I'd just like to thank Catherine Wallace, who was my manager at the time, for the support she provided as my life was turning completely upside down. I've been doing the job for a while. I knew what I was doing, and as I'm sure most people do, I had a routine. And there was a piece of work I did on a Monday morning, but I was reliant on people sending me reports. So I asked myself, how would I feel if I didn't get those reports on Monday morning? Like, how would I really feel, being completely honest with myself? And I started to cry. And I was crying for a couple of days.
Oh, wow.
Because I suddenly realized that thing I prided myself on was a lie that I had been telling myself my whole life. And it was the only criteria holding me back. Now I was 99.9999999% sure I was autistic. And it was such an obvious lie I'd been telling myself. Like whenever I drive and there's a diversion, I fall to pieces because my plan on how to get somewhere has to change. That's why I can find it quite funny looking back at it now, because it was just, it's amazing to me how I couldn't see past this lie. After that, I took the AQ50, which can give a good indication on whether someone is autistic, but it isn't a diagnostic tool in and of itself. The threshold score is 26, meaning 26 or higher may be an indication of autism traits. 73% of people with autism score 32 or higher. I scored 42. That's when I contacted my GP.
Thanks for just being that open, really, Alex. Thank you. Please, can you describe how it felt to receive the diagnosis?
In a word, validating. Imagine you're going through life and, as far as you can tell, all your senses work, but everyone keeps telling you that what you experience isn't actually real. So, as a child, you watch children screaming and running in the playground and hear their parents say they're having fun, whereas to you, frankly, they just look like idiots. I don't understand how this is classified as fun. And actually, on that note, I don't even see having the point in the breaks in the lesson, because if you don't have the break, you go home early, right? All the lessons are done. Isn't that a much better deal? You're forced to wear clothes that have labels and seams that scratch and irritate you and keep distracting you, but you seem to be the only one with that problem, so clearly you're not really experiencing it. That bright light in the middle of the room that's causing you a headache? Well, nobody else has a problem with it, so clearly that means you're not really in pain, does it? You're just making it up. Bonfire night, when all the fireworks are going off and you've got the loud bangs and the big explosions of light, what do you mean you can't stand it? Like, everybody else is loving it. You You're just attention seeking, right? That's what the problem is. Stop acting up. What about poor X? They've had a lot on their plate lately. Like, what have you had to contend with? You should make more of an effort. You're antisocial. No wonder you can't keep a friend. You should try harder. The diagnosis was my validation that everything I said I felt, I did feel. It was real and I wasn't making it up. I was being gaslighted, perhaps unintentionally, but gaslighted nonetheless. And perhaps even worse, I was being made to feel guilty and subhuman. The diagnosis gave me an answer. It made me realise I wasn't this terrible, horrible person some people made me out to be, or at the very least, how they made me feel about myself. It also made me realise that not everything is actually my fault. And I mean, sure, I'm partially to blame for friendships falling apart. I'm not saying I'm blameless. But it's not all my fault. They're at fault as well. It also proved how strong I am. Only 16% of all autistic adults are in full-time employment, and I'm one of the 16%. Yet, I've been told all of my life how unresilient I am and how I should toughen up and I'm too sensitive. Yes, I fall down, and yes, I break, but I get back up and I put myself back together and I continue to carry on no matter what's thrown at me. And there has been a lot thrown at me. That requires strength. I'm living in a world that's not designed for me. It's designed for somebody who doesn't think like me, who doesn't experience things the way I experience them. It's hard, it's confusing, it's painful. And I don't get a say in any of it. I just have to keep finding ways to cope. Sometimes I'm successful, sometimes I'm not. But the expectation is always there for me to conform nonetheless. So I guess the diagnosis has given me a new way to reflect on things, and that's involved doing a lot of challenging my old viewpoints and starting to heal from past experiences. I mean, now I'm actually starting to feel empowered to stand up for myself more. I'm only at the start of this journey, and I've only known for 2 years. I still lived the vast majority of my life without having the diagnosis, and there's clearly still a long way to go, but I am making changes, and those who know me well, they've noticed.
Yeah, and I'm one of them. Yeah. I was really struck by a lot of the things you said there, Alex, but one of the things that hit me hard was when you said you're the only one who's feeling this way, so you're making it up.
Yep.
That's very profound. In your work or in life in general, what do you love working on most, and what do you think you might be best at?
Okay, so I enjoy working on projects, things I can own and develop myself, in work that usually involves an Excel spreadsheet, as you know. And I really enjoy the process of continuous improvement, working out ways to be more efficient and slash processing time to a minimum. I have good attention to detail, and as I've been discovering, I have a knack for designing systems and processes. Outside of work, I have a lot of interests, but some of my special interests I will share include video games, listening to or playing music, history, and the subject of capital punishment. I also really enjoy puzzles. Occasionally, I get a Sudoku book from the supermarket, but I have to limit this as I get super obsessed and can't put the book down all weekend. When I get interested in something, I become hyper-focused on it and will watch and or research that topic for multiple hours. I used to play video games for 12, 16 hours straight, being so absorbed in what I'm doing that I forget to eat or drink. And when I'm in that zone, I never feel the need to take a break. Thankfully, my husband understands this and will remind me, sometimes forcefully, if I'm not taking the hint, to make sure I look after myself properly. I lost a lot of weight last year and really changed my lifestyle, so my ability to sit down and game for that kind of time has gone. But I'll often do some light jogging when playing, providing I find a game that's compatible. And for those that aren't, I'm better at getting up and stretching my legs for a bit, but it doesn't necessarily mean I remember to eat or drink, as my mind will be consumed with what I'm doing and planning out what to do next.
That's a fascinating answer. Just the ability to lose yourself in something for a really huge amount of time, and you need the help of someone else to pull you out of that.
Yeah, and it's just, I don't even know really how to describe it. You just don't ever feel like you need to take a break, and just you lose all sense of time. You're time blind. And there's nothing inside of me that's indicating, oh, you really should eat, or you really need to have a drink, or you haven't gone to the toilet in ages, maybe you need to do that. Nothing indicates to me at all. I'm just completely focused on what I'm doing. So, yeah, I need that outside help.
One of the things that you have taught me about autism that I was wrong about was that I used to think people with autism found it hard to empathize with other people. Can you explain why that's wrong, and also where that misunderstanding comes from?
So I'll be honest, I had to get some help from my husband for this, to come up with some ideas, because I didn't even know where to start. And he helped me appreciate that it's my natural tendency to problem solve that might come across as unempathetic. So if you tell me you have a problem that's upsetting you, I'm not dwelling on the fact you're upset, because I'm trying to solve your problem, because your problem is making you upset. So if I solve the problem, you'll be happy. I do feel sorry for the person, but what does my feeling sorry for them achieve? I'm more likely to start beating myself up if I dwell on the person's feelings, because I feel like I'm not helping them. I can and will validate and acknowledge their emotional state, but I don't see what else I can particularly do. So I guess from my point of view, neurotypicals feel they need coddling, and my approach can unintentionally come across as cold. I think it's somewhat of a defense mechanism also. I have a condition called alexithymia, and that makes it very difficult for me to understand my own emotions or describe them. So when I say I'm fine, I feel absolutely nothing. When I do feel something, it's always intense. So if I say I'm very upset, I can literally feel my heart tearing into pieces. Or if I'm excited, I can't sit still and I'll be running and jumping around. I tend to absorb other people's emotions, and it can be difficult to understand where I end and the other person starts. So it's not that I don't care, but if it's an uncomfortable emotion I'm picking up on and feeling, I want that to go away as quickly as possible. And in my mind, a way to do that is to fix the problem. I can give emotional support, but I need to be close to the person. So, for example, if my husband's had a bad day at work, I will listen and empathize to how he's feeling, but I will also talk it out with him and try and come up with solutions, ideas on how to resolve it. If my husband needs a hug and communicates that to me, I will, of course, give him a hug, but it's not something that naturally crosses my mind as something he might want or need.
Again, it's just such an insightful answer to have given, Alex. Yeah. That leads me to ask this question. Is it true that autistic people cannot tell lies?
I would say no. Autistic people can tell lies. We are human, even though by popular belief, and I've certainly been accused of it myself, we're actually not robots. We are human. My form of autism, however, will say this is far too much trouble than it's worth, and I will therefore tell the truth whilst trying to stay as diplomatic as possible. That sometimes means I dodge answering the question unless I'm pushed. So, for example, I had a change in manager, and I was asked directly if the relationship with my manager was a good one in front of said manager. The answer was no, but I didn't feel like I could say that because I was aware that manager might be hurt if I answered directly. So I talked about how it takes time to adjust to a new manager, learn their style of doing things, whilst they also need time to adjust to their new team. What I said wasn't a lie, but it wasn't the direct truth to the question I was asked. And if I'd been pushed further, I probably would have stayed silent. To tell a lie, I would have to remember a lot of the conversation to remember the context and remember the lie I came up with. I simply don't have enough mental space or energy for any of that. it's not worth my time. I may answer a question and later realise I've made a mistake and misspoke about something, in which case I will reach out to that person and clarify it. It's also important to consider what is lying. Take the greeting, how are you? Most people know to respond with something along the lines of, I'm fine, thanks, how are you? It took me quite a long time, and I do mean quite an embarrassingly long time, to realise people want me to lie. They don't really want to know how I am. This makes absolutely no sense to me. If I was to ask you how you are, it's because I'm genuinely interested. If you feel like you can or want to tell me how things are with you, I'm prepared to listen, good or bad. I really don't understand why people want to start a conversation based on lies and you're lying to each other. It just doesn't make any sense to me. People who know me well know they have to ask me twice if they really want to know if I'm okay, because it's now an automatic response for me. It's part of my script. It's become a part of my autistic mask. If you're not interested, just say hi and leave it at that.
But I think your straightforwardness and your ability to problem solve are two of the things that I respect most of all about you. Yeah. And some of us really do care how you are when we ask as well. But it's a great answer, Alex. Yeah. Are there any unusual behaviours that an autistic person might show that could seem perhaps rude or unusual that you think should be explained? Things like, for example, preferring to wear dark glasses or finding eye contact hard sometimes, for example.
So I think it's important for me to start off by saying an autistic person is not always aware of the things they do that may be causing you offence. So the first thing would be to have an open dialogue about it. And my very strong suggestion on that is to not hint at what's wrong. Just tell them straight. Don't speak in any kind of ambiguous manner. Otherwise, you might not get the desired effect. Mm-hmm. We're not directly trying to hurt you, contrary to what you might believe. So to cover your examples, I will wear sunglasses because I'm sensitive to light. When I put sunglasses on, it can feel like a burden has been lifted off my shoulders, one I didn't even realise I was carrying. I can physically feel the lift off me. It also reduces physical pain and discomfort, and the overwhelm I'm feeling is reduced, which allows me to function better. Eye contact is something I can find uncomfortable, and I'm not sure I really understand why yet. I have theories, but I'm not ready to give a definitive answer about it. However, what I will say is I have strong visual memory. So if someone asks me a question, I believe I don't tend to look at them. I don't actually know because I've not properly analysed this myself yet, but I don't think I really look at them because I will recall visuals better if I'm looking at something neutral like a blank wall. It's almost like a second sight that overlays what my eyes can see, and it allows me to bring up more details. If I had to look at something that was visually stimulating, like looking at someone, I could get distracted because I might see something in the person's body language that then starts to make me feel anxious, for example, and my recall won't be as clear. If I need perfect recall, I tend to shut my eyes so I can focus on the visual memory with nothing else that could possibly distract me.
Again, that's just a really helpful and an open answer to that question. Teaching children, which is what I do, I know that sudden changes in routine or not doing something I said I would do can be very stressful for someone with autism. Would you say that is generally correct, and that it's correct for adults as well?
Resounding yes. The number one argument in my household is, you told me you were going to do X and you didn't. So not doing what you told me you were going to do is immensely stressful. Now, obviously, it does depend on what it is. I'm not going to have the same level of reaction to everything, but I cannot stress enough just how much you are putting me through. Depending on the situation, you not doing something might mean my very carefully crafted military plan has gone out of the window, and that now I need to worry about something I wasn't expecting to, and at the very least, that's going to cause additional stress. Not doing something you told me you were going to do can lead to panic attacks and meltdowns, and I need time to recover from that. So maybe this would be a good time for me to describe the differences. So a panic attack is when I'm overwhelmed but gripped by fear, and it's not necessarily a logical fear response. Quite often I don't know where the fear is coming from. I start having a panic attack and I don't even recognize it's a panic attack, because it's like, well, what am I fearful of? What am I panicked about? I don't know. Wherever I am, I have to leave. There's not a staying put option. I absolutely have to get away from wherever I am. The one time I tried to suppress a panic attack and stay put, I vomited. So quite clearly, when I say I have to go, I have to go. My heart will be racing, I'll be crying from the overwhelming sensation of the attack, and I will be struggling to breathe. And I'd say that these tend to last anywhere between half an hour to 2 hours. Afterwards, I'll be exhausted and feeling wiped out, but I'm still functional and I can still do basic tasks. A meltdown is when I've reached a point of sheer overwhelm, but there's no fear factor. I will probably start crying. I might start raising my voice or shouting. I'll likely be very angry and will all come out in an outburst. Basically, it's when I snap. I think this is when in the past people have felt I'm overreacting to a situation, but they haven't paid attention to the buildup that led to it. And there are warning signs that this is going to happen. I will be irritated. And if I go silent, that is never, ever a good sign. That's when I'm choosing not to say anything, because I know I've lost control and I'm not going to hold back, and silence is my last line of defense. A meltdown will be followed by a shutdown. This is when selective mutism comes in. Now, I really don't like this term, because selective mutism suggests that I'm choosing to be mute. It doesn't mean that at all. I am mute and that's the end of it, and I am choosing absolutely nothing in this scenario. And because I can't speak, I need to be in a dark room and I need to be left alone. I will venture out again when I feel calm and when I feel like I can start processing things again. When a shutdown occurs, my mind goes silent. I can't focus on anything. I can't think about anything. My brain needs to restart the computer and rebuild the database, if you like. And when enough of it has been rebuilt, I can start processing again. Now, there's another thing that can happen, and that's autistic burnout. Burnout is absolutely debilitating. Burnout is when you've reached a point of no return. For me, the best way I can describe it is when something goes wrong with your computer and it needs to go into system recovery, it will boot in safe mode. So the computer's on, but you don't have access to everything. That's what burnout feels like. My brain is on, but I'm not there. I can't sense me. I can do very basic things like follow very simple instructions, but I don't have access to executive functioning, such as making a decision or memories or have any motivation or will to do anything. So, for example, if I'm experiencing burnout, if I feel hungry and go to the fridge, I won't be able to make a decision on what to eat. Anything I would have normally used as determining factors won't be available to me. And I'd rather go hungry than try to force myself to make a decision. That's how hard it is. I don't engage in hobbies unless instructed to do so, because it doesn't even occur to me to do any of them. Often I feel a sensation like inflammation. It's physically painful when I try to prod my mind, and there's a barrier that gets increasingly painful if I try to break through it. The only cure for burnout is time. I can't tell you how long it's going to last, but I can tell you it's a living hell. I feel like a zombie, and it's just truly horrible to go through.
Given what you've just been explaining, in the workplace or in school, can you suggest a couple of things that people with autism are likely to find stressful? Things that, if they were done differently, would make life a lot easier?
Okay, so before I answer that question, I just want to reiterate the point that I can only experience life through my lens. So whatever I feel might help me might do nothing for another person. But to give you an idea of what sort of things autistic people might struggle with, here are my suggestions. So first off, letting them have their own space. The autistic brain likes routine and doesn't like that being disrupted or changed. Don't give an autistic person a hot desk. They're just not going to be able to feel settled. Let them have their own desk in the office, assuming they even have to be there, and let them surround themselves with familiar things that give them comfort. If you don't place them in high traffic areas, like next to a water cooler or printer, let them have their back to a wall and be next to a window, depending on needs for natural light, then I think that would help a lot with anxiety. Second one I can think of is fire alarms. They are insanely loud. And a part of me does wonder if they need to be quite that loud, but let's just assume they do. Could we maybe consider a speaking alarm rather than a bell or persistent alarm sound? Again, it could help alleviate anxiety. I remember being on edge on a Monday when the fire alarm was tested every week, knowing it could go off any second and trying to brace myself for it. One place I used to work at had a fire alarm that didn't just make a loud noise, but would turn off all the lights and a red pulsing light would instead turn on. It would take every ounce of strength for me to get out of the room. I would have found it much easier to accept my fate of death by fire and curl up under the desk. Third point I'd make is extra time off. So I'm not necessarily saying that this has to be paid time off, but every year I save up the maximum amount of holiday I'm allowed to roll over just in case I need to take time off because I'm starting to burn out. Annual leave is supposed to be there so I can do something fun, not sit in a dark room trying to recover from burnout, unable to do anything at all. So whether it's extra annual leave we can take or additional sick leave, we have to have some sort of mechanism that allows me to take time out that I might need without needing to be concerned about my attendance record. If you want me to listen to my body, listen to the signs I'm burning out and do something about it before I'm off for weeks, you have to give me the freedom to say I need a couple of days without fear of repercussions. It could even just be an agreement that I make up the time over a couple of weeks, whatever the case may be. But part of the reason I ignore signs and push past them is because I'm worried about the fallout. Now, the last point I'm going to make, and this is the biggest one of all that I guarantee would benefit any autistic, is to just have a manager and team that is understanding, that is willing to listen, accept there are things you're finding harder than everyone else, and work with you to find a solution. I'm currently in software engineering and they've been absolutely amazing. We come into the office on a Tuesday and to begin with, I was sat with everyone else. But there's a couple of lights in that office that really bother me. The light levels are different to the rest of them. And I was really starting to drain. I didn't feel well on Tuesdays at all. So I spoke to the team about it and they found me a little room attached to the main office where you can control the light. And now I sit in there until we have our meetings and it makes a huge difference to me. I'm not already wiped out before the meeting and then struggling to keep focused during it. If I need to put sunglasses on, nobody minds. Nobody comments. I'm not even sure if anyone notices. But that's what makes me feel included. I can do that in the knowledge nobody will react. It feels safe. We've even had some meetings with the lights off, and I can't say enough how much I appreciate that because they're taking a huge layer of stress away from me and it lessens the impact on my energy so I have more for the rest of the week. I also have an agreement with my manager, which allows me to build up time to take in Lou. So if I feel things are getting on top of me, I can take a day or two to recover. So I hopefully don't fully burn out. So Steve, Archner, Paul, Kai, Sam, Nick, Jeff, and of course our manager, Gary, thank you. I really do mean it when I say I appreciate you all.
Yeah, I know how much you like working in software engineering, and I'm really glad that you're with such a great team at work. How could job interviews be done better, in your opinion?
So interviews are usually about giving a performance from my point of view, and I might not be up to said performance on that particular day. I'm already going to be stressed out. It's an interview and I care that I do well. But the ones I've usually been to involve multiple people around a table asking me a lot of questions that I need to try and appear confident in answering, and that doesn't always happen. I think managers should be aware of different neurotypes, especially if declared in the application. And I think it's a manager's responsibility to take time to understand what that can entail for that person. And that applies to everyone that is on the panel. So, for example, understanding that if the person isn't making eye contact, it doesn't mean they're lying. A more relaxed approach would be beneficial. If you really want to know what I'm like, that will only happen if I don't feel so anxious. Going for a walk, having at least part of the interview in a one-to-one setting, perhaps a relaxed atmosphere like a cafe, would be really helpful. Or book a meeting room with a window where you can control the lights. So if someone is light sensitive, for example, you can accommodate to take away that stress. Asking questions more related to the role rather than anything personal would be helpful too. For example, not asking things like, how would your friends describe you, or what do you like to do at the weekend? It doesn't have anything to do with the job. Having a video of what the room is like, the car parks, the route from the car park, bus stop to where you need to go, anything you can do that takes away the unknown would be enormously helpful, because if I don't know something, that really worries me. I always try and use Google Maps if I have to go somewhere I've not been before, and I always do a dummy run to a place before an interview so I'm more familiar with the drive to mitigate the stress as much as possible.
So again, just hugely insightful, and also some really good practical tips there as well. I know that you really like the phrase, when you have met one autistic person, you have met one autistic person. Can you explain why that's such a good line, in your opinion?
I think a lot of people are familiar with the concept of autism or any other neurological condition as being a spectrum. That is, it's not a linear bar where you're anywhere from 0% to 100% autistic. Instead, there are many factors that make up being autistic, and they affect you in different ways. So, for example, one factor is your sensory profile. I have heightened senses, but I would say in the workplace, light, noise, temperature, and smell affect me the most. I find offices far too bright with all the artificial lights on, gives me a headache, affects my focus, and drains me faster. I cope significantly better if I'm working with only natural light, which is how I work at home. Another person who is also autistic might find they need all the lights on because rather than being hypersensitive, they're hyposensitive to light. We're both autistic, but we have different needs. And that's why I like that phrase, because you can't say, well, Tommy is autistic and we did X, Y, and Z in the office and Tommy is okay, so we'll just do the same for you, because you might have different needs to Tommy, because perhaps your sensory profile is different or your anxiety manifests differently. Perhaps Tommy can speak to a room full of people and the very thought of talking to a couple of people as you're running for the hills. I once read an article that said the brain development differences for people who are neurotypical don't vary too wildly. That's why most standardized lighting doesn't bother someone who is neurotypical. Their eyes and brain are processing light in much the same way as the next person. Yes, there are differences, but they're not wildly different. The differences between one autistic person and another, however, can be like night and day.
This is part of the reason why saying everyone's a little bit autistic is so insulting. I get people may feel they're being inclusive by saying that, but really, it's incredibly dismissive and belittling. If everyone was a little bit autistic, there wouldn't be a diagnosis. If everyone was a little bit autistic, I wouldn't need to explain how things are affecting me. We wouldn't even be having this conversation. I wouldn't need to plan to military precision for every single event that might trigger a panic attack or meltdown. I wouldn't have people acting as if I'm the most horrible person on the planet because I unintentionally didn't follow a social norm, like making eye contact. I wouldn't need to explain that I need time to recover my energy, and that if you prevent me from doing that, then I'm going to end up burnt out and being on sick leave for weeks or even months. If everyone was a little bit autistic, my life expectancy would be the same as yours. The global average life expectancy is 72 years. My life expectancy is around 40 to 58 years. You're expected to retire. I'm not. Now, when I was growing up, looking back now, I fully believe my dad was autistic, and he died 6 days short of his 52nd birthday. And although stress won't be mentioned on his death certificate, stress is exactly, in my opinion, what killed him. Now, my parents were exceptionally good at keeping the bad away from me. I was clueless on so many things growing up, but that didn't mean I didn't notice certain things. And I was only 14 at the time, I guess you could say. My brain was too immature to piece it all together back then, but as an adult, when I reflect back, I can see it, I can piece it together, I can see where it started, and I can see the escalation. This is why I say that, to me, the condition is a stress management one. Recommended adjustments aren't just to put me on a level playing field with everybody else so that I can be the best version of myself at work. It's more than that. It's just so I can live. Now, I'm not saying all of this to cause offence or to lecture anybody. I'm saying it because when someone says that to me, what I hear is, you're just the same as everyone else, so your needs don't matter. What you experience is nothing. And as I've already said, that's gaslighting. I've had 39 years of that. I no longer accept that narrative.
Yeah, wow, Hopes. That's hugely powerful. I really didn't know that about life expectancy, for example. And that's a really important answer that you've just given there.
Yeah, and a lot of it is down to stress, and certainly I've read heart failure can be quite a common cause of death, and it is all stress related because we're living in a world that's not designed for us.
I hope it's not a flippant question, but if I had a magic wand and I could make your autism go away, would you want me to do that for you?
Nope. And I wouldn't want you to do that because then I wouldn't be me.
Yes, just a perfect answer. I'm so happy that you said that, yeah. Alex, thank you for doing this, for putting yourself out there, for going way outside your comfort zone, and for wanting to help more people to understand.
That's absolutely fine. And like I said before, this is all I really want. I just want to help somebody, whether it's a manager understanding things or whether it's somebody realizing actually maybe they are on the autism spectrum, that they've been struggling with things all their life and not known what label to give that or know what to research to find that out. If it can help just one person, then I've done what I've set out to do. And just a big thank you for giving me this platform to do it.